Welcome to The Economist magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm volunteer reader Steve Veach. Thanks for tuning in. During the next hour, you'll hear articles from the December 6th to December 12th edition of the magazine. On the cover this week, an illustration of a young girl, looking rather bewildered as no fewer than 7 robotic arms are trying to hand things to her, including a science book, a hairbrush, a video game controller, a smartphone, a tube of lipstick, a cup of coffee, or maybe tea, and a violin. The headline, How AI is Rewiring Childhood. The cover leader, Generation AI. How AI is Rewiring Childhood. The technology presents dazzling opportunities and ominous risks. That will be followed by 4 additional leader section articles, starting with Crackpot or Jackpot, Britain's Slot Machine Politics. Voting is becoming a high-stakes, wildly unpredictable gamble. Then, squabbling while Ukraine burns. Enough dithering. Europe must pay to save Ukraine. America will not. Europe's security depends on agreeing how to. Then, 2 cheers for Ahmad al-Sharaa. Syria's transition has gone better than expected. The president has been a deft diplomat, but must do more to reassure Syrians. Then finally, choosing the chair. Chris Waller, not Kevin Hassett, should lead the Federal Reserve. President Trump should choose the technocrat over the partisan. Then we'll go to the United States section for 2 articles. The first, Drifting with Purpose. Will Congress rein in Pete Hegseth and his boat bombing campaign? A deadly strike raises stark questions about America's anti-drug war. And Concepts of a Plan. Republicans still don't know with Obamacare. Expiring subsidies are a big political headache. We begin, as always, with the cover leader, Generation AI. How AI is Rewiring Childhood. The technology presents dazzling opportunities and ominous risks. Christmas stockings may contain more surprises than usual this year, as children open presents that can talk back. Toy makers in China have declared 2025 the year of artificial intelligence, or AI, and are producing robots and teddies that can teach, play, and tell stories. Older children, meanwhile, are glued to viral AI videos and AI-enhanced games. At school, many are being taught with materials created with tools like ChatGPT. Some are even learning alongside chatbot tutors. In work and play, AI is rewiring childhood. It promises every child the kind of upbringing previously available only to the rich, with private tutors, personalized syllabuses, and bespoke entertainment. Children can listen to songs composed about them, read stories in which they star, play video games that adapt to their skill level, and have an entourage of chatbot friends cheering them on. A childhood fit for a king could become universal. It is a future filled with opportunities and hidden traps. As real kings often discover, a bespoke upbringing can also be a lonely and atomized one. What's more, as their subjects often find out, it can create adults who are ill-equipped for real life. As AI changes childhood for better and for worse, society must rethink the business of growing up. Being reared by robots has advantages. Tech firms are already showing how AI can enhance learning, especially where teachers and materials are scarce. Literacy and language learning have been boosted in early trials. The dream is that with an AI tutor, children can be saved from classes pitched to the median, in which bright pupils are bored and dim ones are lost. If you want a version of this leader for an 8-year-old Hindi speaker, AI can rewrite it. If they would prefer it as a cartoon strip or a song, no problem. Technology is creating new forms of fun, too. Hollywood may dismiss AI videos as slop, but young people are devouring them and making their own. Old toys are being upgraded. An AI-powered edition of Trivial Pursuit can pose questions on any topic. Video games are creating novel experiences, such as chatting to Darth Vader in Fortnite. Any child can meet their heroes and shoot them. There are well-publicized risks in letting children loose on an evolving technology. AI tutors may hallucinate wrong answers. Toys can go off the rails. Parents should check stockings for the AI teddy that was recently found to have spiced up its chat with talk of kinky sex. Children can easily misuse AI to cheat at homework or harass each other with deepfake videos. Chatbots can coax vulnerable adolescents into harming themselves. Tech firms insist these stumbling blocks can be fixed. ChatGPT is only 3 years old. Yet, childhood may be disrupted most radically by things that AI does when it is behaving as intended. The technology quickly learns what its master likes and shows more of it. Social media feeds have already created echo chambers where people see only views they agree with or love to hate. AI threatens to strengthen these echo chambers and lock children into them at an early age. The child who likes football may be told football stories by his teddy and given footballing examples by his AI tutor. Not only does this stamp out serendipity, a favorites-only diet means a child need never learn to tolerate something unfamiliar. One-sided relationships with chatbots present a similar risk. AI companions that never criticize nor share feelings of their own are a poor preparation for dealing with imperfect humans. A third of American teenagers say they find chatting to an AI companion at least as satisfying as talking to a friend, and easier than talking to their parents. Yes bots threaten to create children not used to taking turns, who grow up into colleagues unable to compromise and partners unfamiliar with the give and take required in a relationship. Other trends are pushing in the same direction. As birth rates crash, fewer children are growing up with siblings to smooth their sharp edges. Rising numbers of young adults are deciding that long-term romantic relationships are not worth the hassle. Remote work means that people who grow up in a personalized, asocial world can slip into jobs where they interact with colleagues only through screens, a chore they may soon delegate to an AI agent. Some basic countermeasures are urgent. Parents should think twice before entrusting their child to a word regurgitation machine, whether it is sewn into a bear or not. Chatbots should have age restrictions that are properly enforced. Governments should not give AI firms the leeway they gave social media networks, which are only now being cajoled into age gating. Teachers are kidding themselves if they think essays written at home can any longer be trusted. In the age of AI, more in-school assessment is essential. The longer-term challenge is to think deeply about how to preserve the socialization that AI could rub out of children's lives. Schools, where much of childhood plays out, are the best place to do this. They should take advantage of personalized tuition where it is proven to work, but they must also redouble efforts to teach things that a robot can't. To debate, to disagree, and to get along with, perhaps even appreciate, people who are not as sycophantic as a chatbot. Schools should also enhance their role as centers of discovery. If AI is giving children more of what they want, it is important that schools provide chances to meet people and encounter ideas that lie outside their experience. algorithmic personalization threatens to be a powerful barrier to social mobility if it nudges people to stay in the lane in which they start out. Inequality could widen if poor schools merely embrace chatbots as cheap substitutes for human teachers. AI shows undeniable potential to improve education and enrich entertainment. It may one day let every child live like royalty, but the truly privileged may be those whose parents and teachers know when to turn it off. That was the cover leader, Generation AI, How AI is Rewiring Childhood. The technology presents dazzling opportunities and ominous risks. We move now to leader article number 2, which, coincidentally, is the cover leader in Britain. Crackpot or jackpot? Britain's slot machine politics. Voting is becoming a high-stakes, wildly unpredictable gamble. Elections are supposed to distill the will of the people. These days, they are more likely to scramble it. Going by recent polling, a general election held today could lead to a landslide for Reform UK, which now has just 5 MPs. Or voters could return a hung parliament. Perhaps the Conservatives will be the kingmaker. But then again, if the Tory vote slips a bit further, the world's most successful political party could be reduced to a rump of just 15 MPs. Zach Polanski of the Greens, currently 4 MPs, has a 1 in 20 chance of becoming leader of His Majesty's opposition in a reform-led parliament. But if the Labour Party can get to within 2 percentage points of reform, it will have a 1 in 3 chance of forming the next government, making Sir Keir Starmer one of the most successful, while also one of the most loathed, prime ministers of the 21st century. Welcome to Slot Machine Britain, where Election Day gives the people a chance to pull the lever on a one-armed bandit. Our bewildering range of outcomes emerges not so much from a belief that the polls could seesaw wildly, though they may do that too, as from the fact when 5 parties score between 13% and 29%, small changes in their share of the vote lead to big changes in their share of the seats in Parliament. For a while now, Britons have been aware that they face arbitrariness and instability at the ballot box. This week, The Economist is using a new electoral model to put flesh on that intuition. For those who care about good government or democracy, our findings are not reassuring. Those people include Sir Keir, who, in an interview with us this week, warns that the emergence of the populist right is, quote, the political fight of our times. The fundamental cause of the uncertainty is political fragmentation, and it is a feature of many European democracies. In France, National Rally and La France Insoumise have drawn support away from the socialists, the Republicans, and Renaissance in the center. Alternative for Germany and various parties on the left, including Die Linke, have eroded the 2 big national groupings there. Italy is also far down this route. It is the same story in Britain, where a 2-party duopoly has been crumbling since the 1960s. Lately, the decline has accelerated as the loyalty of voters to individual parties has withered. Reform, an upstart led by Nigel Farage, has become Britain's most popular party. Under Mr. Polanski, a former actor who rivals Mr. Farage for wit and off-the-cuff policymaking, the Greens have overtaken Labour as the first choice of those under 35. Separatists are thriving in Scotland and Wales. Britain turbocharges this turmoil because of its election system. Under first-past-the-post voting, everyone casts a single ballot, and the candidate with the most in each of Britain's 650 constituencies wins a seat. In theory, this rewards the two big parties, supposedly leading to strong government. However, when the country has lots of medium-sized parties, the correlation between the number of votes in and number of seats out owes more to Las Vegas than to Edmund Burke. To make sense of the confusion, we have built a model that draws on 80 years of electoral data. This uses 10,001 simulations to calculate what could happen in a vote based on today's polling. We find that in some constituencies, seats could be won on as little as 23% of the vote. Reform is likely to be the largest party, but its possible tally of seats spans a huge range, from 112 to 373. The difference between Mr. Farage leading a rump opposition and becoming prime minister. Whoever wins, the consequence is likely to be weaker government and more contempt for parliament. One problem is that majorities will be built on sand. In the election in 2024, Labour won 63% of the seats on 34% of the vote. The most disproportionate result in British political history. As its polling has dwindled, however, Labour MPs have become aware that their seats are under threat. Despite having a big majority, therefore, Sir Keir has had to grapple with rebellious and risk-averse backbenchers unwilling to fall in with his plans. Another problem is that governments elected on a small share of the vote do not have a mandate for the sweeping reform Britain needs. If they take harsh measures, they will be accused of failing to reflect the will of the majority in the country. But if they sit on their hands and do nothing, they risk being accused by their own voters of making empty manifesto promises. It is a recipe for disillusionment with democracy. Britain has in the past seen powerful challenges to the two-party system, such as the SDP in the early 1980s, only for them to melt away. This time, too, it is tempting to credit the rise of the insurgents to Sir Keir's bloodless leadership, or to think that fragmentation is simply a temporary flare-up over inflation and immigration. Perhaps the incentives for creating big parties under the first-past-the-post voting system will be large enough to lead to another consolidation. However, the forces propelling the shift from two dominant parties to many competing ones are unlikely to abate. The habit of party loyalty is easily lost, but hard to regain. On both the left and the right, you find the same frustration. Voters feel that the Westminster system no longer responds to their wishes. If the slot machine amplifies the volatility of the electorate, then that could further alienate voters. Eventually, this will lead to growing pressure for electoral reform. Already supported by a majority of Britons, this may one day become inevitable, whether Westminster politicians want it or not. In his interview, Sir Keir acknowledges that voters feel frustrated and disenfranchised and no longer trust centrist politicians to improve their lives. But he warns where this could lead. If there is a conservative government, he says, I can sleep at night. But a populist right government led by Mr. Farage, quote, would be a different proposition. Sir Keir's answer is to prove, between now and the election, that national renewal, patriotism, and progressive policies can meet Britain's challenges. What makes the path so treacherous is that, even if he succeeds, the slot machine could make him a loser. That was Leader Article number 2, Crackpot or Jackpot, Britain's Slot Machine Politics. Voting is becoming a high-stakes, wildly unpredictable gamble. And we move now to Leader Article number 3, Squabbling While Ukraine Burns. Enough dithering. Europe must pay to save Ukraine. America will not. Europe's security depends on agreeing how to. Europe is breathing a sigh of relief. On December 2nd, Donald Trump's envoy, Steve Witkoff, held lengthy talks about Ukraine with Vladimir Putin in Moscow, and not much happened. Many had been expecting Team Trump to sell out Ukrainian sovereignty in return for commercial deals. The risk of such an odious stitch-up now seems to have receded a bit. Thanks to pressure from European leaders and some sensible Republicans, including the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, some of the worst elements of a 28-point plan hatched by Mr. Witkoff and his Kremlin chum, Kirill Dmitriev, have quietly been dropped. Mr. Putin seems unenthusiastic about the current version. Mr. Trump now says the whole thing is, quote, a mess. Diplomacy, like the war, will grind on. But if European governments think they are off the hook, they are wrong. First, another bad pseudo-peace plan could pop up. Second, even if it doesn't, Ukraine will need solid military and financial support for the foreseeable future, and it will have to come from Europe. It is still not clear that Europeans grasp this. When Mr. Putin launched his full-scale, unprovoked invasion, Europe did the right thing. The EU and others imposed stiff sanctions on Russia and gave military and financial aid to Ukraine, roughly matching the level of support from America. But that united front depended on the White House agreeing that territorial aggression should not be rewarded. Mr. Trump has blown that consensus apart. Now, the $90 to $100 billion it costs each year to support Ukraine's war effort, a burden previously divided evenly, must be shouldered by Europe alone. As our calculations earlier this year showed, it is a large sum in the aggregate, but a small price to pay for Europe's security. The annual GDP of the EU alone is nearly $20 trillion. Russia may be advancing on the battlefield, but only slowly and at a huge cost in men and money. So Europe faces three strategic tasks. First, to make Mr. Putin realize he cannot win, by convincing him that Europe, which has an economy 10 times larger than Russia's, will never abandon Ukraine. Second, to reassure Ukraine. Third, to show the MAGA crew that Europe is not the feeble, free-riding bloc they say it is. On all three, Europe is coming up short. Nothing illustrates this better than an EU squabble over some 210 billion euros, or $245 billion, of frozen Russian assets, much of it lodged at a clearinghouse in Brussels. The G7 agreed last year to use the interest generated by the invader's frozen assets to support its victim. But this is not enough. An EU summit in October was supposed to agree on a more creative way to mobilize the assets, using some of them to back a, quote, reparations loan to Ukraine, which would be repaid only if Russia pays compensation for the harm it has inflicted. Belgium wants other European countries to share the risk that Russia might sue to retrieve its assets. A deal ought to be possible, but so far all proposals, including a complex one from the Commission this week, have failed to win assent. If Europe will not or cannot deploy the frozen assets, it must use its own balance sheet. Soon. That means common borrowing, eurobonds, strategic autonomy bonds, whatever label is politically palatable. Ukraine needs predictable, multi-year financing, a 4 or 5 year package it can count on to keep its budget afloat, manufacture shells, and rebuild power plants. Europe's current dribs and drabs approach is the opposite of strategic. It forces Ukraine to live from one donor meeting to the next. It encourages Mr. Putin to wait the West out. And it offers ammunition to those in Mr. Trump's inner circle who argue that Europe is incapable of serious statecraft. That was leader article number 3, squabbling while Ukraine burns. Enough dithering. Europe must pay to save Ukraine. America will not. Europe's security depends on agreeing how to. And we move on now to leader article number 4. 2 cheers for Ahmed al-Sharaa. Syria's transition has gone better than expected. The president has been a deft diplomat, but must do more to reassure Syrians. From the start of Syria's revolution in 2011, the regime said the country faced a choice: Assad or chaos. The dynasty that had ruled since 1971 warned that Syria would collapse without its iron grip. This was always a lie. It was Bashar al-Assad's refusal to stand down and his murder and torture of peaceful protesters that plunged Syria into civil war. On December 8, 2024, after a lightning rebel offensive, the hated tyrant was forced to flee into exile. The past year has proved that his country can cope remarkably well without him. His successor, Ahmed al-Sharaa, is exactly the sort of character Mr. Assad told his loyalists and outsiders to fear, a former jihadist. Yet Syria has not tipped into chaos. Though there are reasons to worry about the kind of state Mr. Sharaa is building, he has done a laudable job of holding the country together. Start with his performance on the world stage, where he has proved to be a deft diplomat. He has charmed his Western counterparts, chief among them President Donald Trump, who welcomed him to the White House last month. America has temporarily waived the sanctions it imposed on Syria during Mr. Assad's rule and is working to scrap them. Gulf states are mostly enthusiastic about Mr. Sharaa, and he is laboring to make peace with Israel, which has unwisely met his overtures with hostility. All this adds up to a profound change in the Middle East, a country that was once a despotic client of Iran and Russia, is now trying to join the region's pro-Western camp. Instead of flooding its neighbors with illicit drugs, Syria's main export in the latter days of Mr. Assad's regime, it is now courting Gulf states for investment. Next, consider what has not happened since Mr. Assad's flight from Damascus. Syria has not lapsed back into civil war, a fate that befell other Arab countries after their own violent revolutions. Nor has Mr. Sharaa sought to impose Islamic laws. Bars in Damascus are still serving. Women are not forced to cover up or stay at home. The president has been a pragmatist. Syria's economy has been wrecked by war and sanctions. GDP is down more than 70% since 2011. Millions of people need homes, jobs, and services. Mr. Sharaa has not fixed their problems, but no Syrian leader could have done so in a single year. It is unfair to fault him for failing to do the impossible. However, it is not too soon to judge the way he is trying to govern. He seems uninterested in rebuilding the formal state, which was hollowed out by dictatorship. Instead, he is creating parallel structures. His decision last month to establish a new customs authority, run by a former jihadist comrade, does not bode well. Syria's main source of tax revenue is now controlled by a crony, rather than by the finance ministry. Furthermore, Mr. Sharaa has done far too little to reassure minority groups. Pro-government forces committed 2 atrocious massacres of religious minorities this year, killing Alawites in March and Druze in July. Mr. Sharaa condemned the killings and says the right things about Syria's mosaic of faiths and ethnicities. But he acts as if he is oblivious to the fact that many Alawites, Druze, and Christians view a Sunni-dominated state led by an ex-jihadist as a danger. He must do more to share power, which today is concentrated among a handful of his relatives and confidants. Ministries should be buttressed rather than bypassed. He should engage more with the robust civil society that emerged during the Civil War. An early test will come when Syria's new parliament is seated, probably in January. It could be a check on presidential authority. It could also prove to be a rubber stamp, like the old regime's legislature. That would be a tragedy. Mr. Sharaa has done a commendable job in his first year. But his task is not just to hold Syria together. It is to create something that is different from the one-man show he overthrew. That was Leader Article number 4. Two cheers for Ahmad al-Sharaa. Syria's transition has gone better than expected. The president has been a deft diplomat, but must do more to reassure Syrians. And this is a good time to pause and remind you that you are listening to The Economist magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This program featuring articles from the December 6th to December 12th edition of the magazine. We continue on now with Leader Article number 5, the last of our leaders for this program. Choosing the chair. Chris Waller, not Kevin Hassett, should lead the Federal Reserve. President Trump should choose the technocrat over the partisan. On November 30th, President Donald Trump said he had decided whom to nominate as the next chair of the Federal Reserve. He has since said he will reveal his choice early next year. In betting markets, money has piled on Kevin Hassett, his trusted economic advisor. Mr. Trump is desperate for the Fed to cut interest rates faster. He has tried to oust Lisa Cook, a Fed governor. The row over whether he can will be heard by the Supreme Court in January. And he has already put one of his advisors, Stephen Miran, on the Fed board temporarily. Mr. Miran has voted for bumper rate cuts. As chair, Mr. Hassett would paddle in the same direction. It is common for the Fed chair to have a party affiliation. If having worked in the White House were a bar, then neither Alan Greenspan nor Janet Yellen could have occupied the role. Mr. Hassett also has some qualifications for the top job. Before joining the first Trump administration in 2017, he was a respected, if partisan, economist who had been published in leading journals. No one can claim he would be ignorant of the dangers of setting interest rates to keep Mr. Trump happy or debt cheap, rather than to control inflation. The question is how much Mr. Hassett would care about those risks. While working for Mr. Trump, he has behaved like a hack, unconcerned with reality. In 2017, his, quote, very conservative estimate was that Mr. Trump's corporate tax cuts would boost annual household incomes by $4,000 on average, far above other estimates at the time, and any effect picked up since. In May 2020, his, quote, cubic model of the COVID-19 pandemic projected that deaths would soon cease entirely. Absurdities such as these have torched his scholarly reputation. Even before entering the White House, he made one of the worst forecasts in history. In 1999, near the height of the dot-com boom, he predicted a near quadrupling of the Dow Jones Index. There is a candidate whose record is far superior. Chris Waller has sat on the Fed's board since 2020 and has worked in the Fed system since 2009, and was previously an academic. Whereas Mr. Hassett's research concerned tax policy, Mr. Waller is a monetary policy expert and has a strong record of divining where the economy is headed. In 2022, many prominent forecasters, including a former chief economist of the IMF, Olivier Blanchard, predicted that recent rises in interest rates would cause a surge in unemployment. Mr. Waller vocally disagreed and was proved right. This year, he foresaw weakness in the labor market that struck in July and which caused the Fed to take a dovish turn. Over a long period, his judgment looks equally sound. Compared with colleagues, he was dovish in the 2010s when the economy was weak, and hawkish after the pandemic, as inflation was taking off. Like Mr. Hassett, Mr. Waller wants lower rates today. This newspaper is not convinced. Inflation is still well above the 2% target, and America's labor market may be stronger than it looks. But there is little doubt that Mr. Waller is making his case in good faith, and that under his leadership, the Fed's independence would be secure. To Mr. Trump, that is a bad thing. Yet the president should be careful what he wishes for. His main political problem is high prices, something that excessively loose monetary policy would make worse. And if the central bank's independence were threatened, investors would revolt, and America's long-term borrowing costs would rise. Appointing a technocrat rather than a partisan is not just the right choice. It is also in the interests of the Republican Party. That was Leader Article Number 5, Choosing the Chair. Chris Waller, not Kevin Hassett, should lead the Federal Reserve. President Trump should choose the technocrat over the partisan. And we move now to the United States section for two articles, beginning with Drifting with Purpose. Will Congress rein in Pete Hegseth and his boat-bombing campaign? A deadly strike raises stark questions about America's anti-drug war. It was a scandal waiting to happen, and now it has. For over 3 months, America's armed forces have conducted a relentless air campaign against suspected drug smuggling boats in the Caribbean and Pacific. To date, they have carried out 21 confirmed strikes, which have killed at least 83 people, many of them apparently civilian smugglers. There has been no legal oversight. A meek Republican majority in Congress appeared content to abdicate its war powers to an imperial presidency. No more. Republican and Democratic lawmakers alike are demanding answers about reports of an alleged war crime committed at the outset of the boat strike campaign by American special forces. The controversy has put America's Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, under scrutiny once again, and may yet change the conduct of the Trump administration's norm-smashing anti-drug operation. Immediately at issue is what happened to 11 suspected drug traffickers killed during the campaign's first attack on September 2nd. On November 28th, The Washington Post reported that an initial missile strike against a vessel carrying the traffickers left two survivors clinging to the shipwreck. Commanders watching the operation unfold over a live video feed reportedly spotted the two men, but Admiral Frank Bradley, the special operations commander in charge, ordered a second strike, blowing them up. If that description is accurate, it is likely that American forces committed a war crime. It is illegal to strike people who are out of action and posing no threat. The Pentagon's own manual on the law of armed conflict points out that it is, quote, dishonorable and inhumane to attack people incapacitated by shipwreck. Killing the survivors of an attack at sea is, quote, literally the textbook definition of an unlawful order, says Stephen Lepper, who served as the Air Force's second highest ranking lawyer. Who was responsible? The White House has acknowledged the second strike, but is hedging about how it happened. Mr. Hegseth has made clear that his written order authorizing the entire boat strike campaign, known as an, quote, execute order, in military speak, demanded lethal action. Yet the secretary has denied authorizing, quote, no quarter for survivors. Unless the text becomes public, it will remain hard to judge what requirements the Secretary of War laid down for Admiral Bradley, who has been summoned to Congress to answer questions in private on December 4th. In recent days, the White House has shifted the onus onto the Admiral, stating that he was responsible for ordering the second strike. I stand by him and the combat decisions he has made, Mr. Hegseth posted to social media on December 1st. In the absence of clearer facts, what happens next may hinge on two questions. The first is whether Mr. Hegseth's execute order was illegal from the outset. The other is how robust the decision-making process and legal safeguards were in the operations room when Admiral Bradley reportedly approved the follow-on strike. As is common, Mr. Hegseth's order appears to have delegated authority to carry out the strike through the chain of command to Admiral Bradley, then in charge of Joint Special Operations Command, or JSOC, home of elite secretive forces such as the Army's Delta Force and the Navy's SEALs. The Admiral is well respected in special operations circles and had the right background to oversee the mission. He is extremely experienced in this type of individual and lethal targeting, says a former Senior Judge Advocate General, or JAG, the military's uniformed lawyers. He spent most of his professional career doing this in Iraq or Afghanistan, he said. Far-flung air and missile strikes are typically carried out from a joint operations center, a hub for coordinating missions with units in the field, linked by a live video feed. Mr. Hegseth watched the operation live on video, although he claims he did not, quote, stick around to witness the second strike. In any case, it would be highly unusual for a Secretary of Defense, now rebranded Secretary of War, to intervene once the operation was underway, say officials familiar with the process. Admiral Bradley would also have been flanked by a gaggle of aides specializing in operations, intelligence, munitions, and, crucially, a JAG to advise on whether the strikes were legal. Typically, commanders will survey the room to get sign-off from a JAG and other officers before launching a strike. Yet, JAGs lack formal authority in the chain of command. They do not have a veto, points out Daniel Maurer, a former Army lawyer now at Ohio Northern University. According to the Post, Admiral Bradley justified the follow-on strike as necessary to remove a potential navigation hazard for other vessels. The Pentagon has fired multiple times on different drug boats to remove them as potential hazards. Yet legal experts argue that it is a legally dubious rationalization in a case where survivors are present. The question is which would take priority, removal of the hazard or care for the wounded, says the former senior JAG. Care for the wounded is a function of international treaty law. A bigger question is whether America's entire anti-drug campaign is legally defensible. Although the Trump administration argues it is engaged in an, quote, armed conflict with drug gangs, few legal scholars believe that blowing up drug boats fits that definition. In many ways, the campaign is indicative of Mr. Hegseth's broader contempt for the laws of war. Since taking office, he has gutted the Pentagon's Civilian Harm Mitigation and Response Office and fired a multitude of senior JAGs. Mr. Hegseth often rails against what he claims are restrictive rules of engagement, which, quote, tie the hands of soldiers in the field. Morale within the JAG Corps is tanking. Many of the new lawyers installed in senior posts over recent months, quote, don't care what the right answer is, bemoans the former senior JAG. They spend all their time trying to figure out what the administration wants and then reverse engineer how to get to it. The controversy over the September 2nd strike may provide a service by focusing scrutiny on why the Trump administration is using disproportionate force against criminals in speedboats. Narco gangs are not Al-Qaeda or Islamic State. Whether these boats justify this kind of interdiction is really the question, says a former JAG who advised JSOC operations. That's the debate we should be having. That was the first of two articles from the United States section, Drifting with Purpose. Will Congress rein in Pete Hegseth and his boat bombing campaign? A deadly strike raises stark questions about America's anti-drug war. And we'll continue now with another article from the United States section, Concepts of a Plan. Republicans still don't know with Obamacare. Expiring subsidies are a big political headache. Picture a Republican voter. Perhaps they are in Texas or Florida, a farmer, or someone running their own small company. These people are more likely to get their health insurance with supercharged subsidies for the Affordable Care Act, or ACA, marketplaces. The boosted tax credits are set to expire at the end of December, probably causing 3.5 million people to become uninsured by 2027, according to the Congressional Budget Office, a nonpartisan scorekeeper. But despite the fact that many of their voters rely on them, Republicans in Congress and in the White House have yet to decide on a solution, or even if this is a problem. The question over what to do about the enhanced subsidies was behind the latest government shutdown. Though the government reopened, Republicans are still stuck. The Senate is to vote as soon as next week on the future of the boosted subsidies, but what it is voting on is still unclear. Mike Johnson, the House Speaker, is not guaranteeing a vote at all. Avoiding the debate might not be an option for much longer. As the deadline gets closer, the proposals are becoming even more radical. What to do about the enhanced subsidies has become a microcosm of divisions in the Republican coalition, reaching into debates on affordability, concerns about the deficit, and even abortion. Since the COVID-era introduction of the enhanced tax credits, enrollment in the Obamacare marketplaces, where people can compare and buy health insurance, has doubled. Now, more than 24 million people buy their insurance this way, three-quarters of them in states Mr. Trump won in the last election. The enhanced subsidies are expensive. Extending them until 2035 would cost $350 billion, according to the Congressional Budget Office. This is about as much as the Inflation Reduction Act spent on clean energy, and explains why the Democratic architects of the extra subsidies made them temporary. There are many Republicans who don't view expiry as a problem, says Douglas Holtz Aiken, a longtime Republican advisor. They were meant to be temporary. They can go away. Some Republican health care wonks do welcome their end, but others in the party are less sanguine. Some House Republicans have urged Mr. Johnson to, quote, chart a conservative path that protects working families. One idea, backed and then dropped by the White House, is to extend the subsidies for 2 years and introduce an income cap. An income limit of around $110,000 for an individual, quote, would not be very disruptive, says Ben Summers, a Harvard health economist. It would save a little bit of money, and the optics of it might be favorable. The Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, a think tank, estimates the White House's maybe plan would still cost $50 billion over 2 years, just $5 billion less than extending the current subsidies. Some Republican senators are proposing more radical ideas, inspired by Mr. Trump's recent call to, quote, send the money directly back to the people. Senator Rick Scott of Florida proposed giving the equivalent value of the boosted subsidy to Americans to pay for health expenses or premiums, including for low-quality insurance. States would have the choice of whether to opt in. Perversely, that would almost certainly make the ACA marketplace collapse in those states, warns Cynthia Cox of KFF, a health research outfit. Only the sickest would still seek out coverage, making insurance pools ever more expensive, creating what health economists ominously call a death spiral. Bill Cassidy, the Louisiana senator and doctor, has proposed using the money from the enhanced subsidies to help people pay for hefty deductibles on a different type of marketplace plan. Given that this would not aim to save the federal government any money, quote, it is not clear what problem that's trying to solve, says Thomas Buckmuller, of the University of Michigan. Some policymakers hope that by giving people cash, they, quote, are going to be shoppers. Mr. Buckmueller says, comparing medicines costs now that they are paying more directly. Health policy wonks scoff at trying to implement this in a month before the enhanced subsidies expire, or even before the midterms. Hanging over all these dry policy debates about risk pools and premiums is a moral question. The ACA always blocked federal subsidies from paying for abortion. Meanwhile, some states require plans to cover the procedure. This contradiction has led to complicated accounting, whereby abortion care is paid for by a fund kept separate from federal money. Anti-abortion activists are pushing for any extension of the tax credits to stop plans subsidized by the federal government from covering abortion, regardless of such bookkeeping tricks. Continuing the status quo risks fracturing the Republican coalition, warns John Mize of Americans United for Life. I can't imagine either the administration or congressional leadership has any kind of appetite to do that, he says. Given the filibuster in the Senate and the narrow Republican majority in the House, any legislation on extending the supercharged subsidies will require Democratic votes to pass. Changing the rules over abortion would prove just as fractious to their coalition, too. Planned Parenthood Action Fund has already lined up opposition to any discussion of the change. All this leaves Republicans at an impasse, making expiry the most likely option. The wavering is not popular. Three-quarters of Americans support extending the boosted subsidies, according to a KFF poll from November, including 44% of self-identified MAGA Republicans. I'm surprised that the Republicans don't seem a little more nervous about this, reflects Benedict Ippolito of the American Enterprise Institute, a think tank. He points out that ending a policy is harder than starting one, as, quote, it becomes very, very easy to characterize who loses. Mr. Trump still seems to be deciding. Last week, he said he would, quote, rather not extend the enhanced subsidies at all, before swiftly acknowledging that, in fact, quote, some kind of extension may be necessary. That was an article from the United States section, Concepts of a Plan. Republicans still don't know with Obamacare. Expiring subsidies are a big political headache. And I think we have just enough time for one more short article, this one a bit lighter, from the Culture section. Show Me the Doors. Why there is an advent calendar for absolutely everything. Do you want 24 pots of slime or packets of pork scratchings? Advent calendars never used to be much fun. Each day in December, as part of the lead-up to Christmas, you would peel back a card door to reveal a Bible verse or a picture of a church bell. Only if your parents were cool would you get a chocolate calendar. These days, however, advent calendars feature fewer bells and more bells and whistles. You can buy one not just for your children, but also for your parents, pets, and even the birds in your garden. If you are feeling indulgent, you can choose a calendar stuffed with port wine or pork scratchings. If you are on a pre-Christmas health kick, you can pick one filled with protein powder or workout gear. Some calendars are sumptuous. A 12-day caviar countdown will set you back almost $1,000. Others are sensible, 24 tools, or silly, 24 pots of slime. Shoppers cannot get enough of them. A recent poll by Ipsos in Britain found that 72% of respondents buy advent calendars. A calendar by Bon Maman, a jam brand, sells out in America every year. The brand has increased production by 400% since 2017 to meet demand. Beauty is also pretty popular. Space NK's cosmetics calendar, one of the most popular of 2025, sold out in weeks. Advent calendars can seem odd. The tradition started in the early 19th century with German Protestants, who marked the season by lighting candles or drawing lines of chalk. paper calendars spread across the world after the Second World War, when spirits needed lifting. Why have they taken off? One reason is that today's Advent calendars speak to, quote, the trend of small indulgences, says Liz Morgan of Fortnum & Mason, a British department store. Calendars offer a taste of luxury, akin to indulging in a fancy coffee. Leonard Lauder, a cosmetics tycoon, called it the, quote, lipstick effect. Sales of the makeup product rose during economic downturns as women sought a forgivably inexpensive pick-me-up. They often contained appealingly exclusive or collectible products. Liberty included a limited edition bag in its popular advent calendar this year. The London department store held a swanky party in September to celebrate its release. Rare products create a buzz on social media. There are 1.3 million videos tagged hashtag advent calendar on TikTok. Advent calendars offer benefits for brands, such as attracting new customers. Some are eager to extend the custom beyond Christmas. Halloween advent calendars have already started spooking the shelves. Kate Turvey, director of the Advent Calendar Shop, which stocks more than 500 different types, reckons countdowns to Mother's Day or birthdays other than Jesus's may soon take off. Who wouldn't want that festive feeling of anticipation all year round? That was an article from the culture section, Show Me the Doors, why there is an advent calendar for absolutely everything. Do you want 24 pots of slime or packets of pork scratchings? And that does bring us to the end of our time for this program. Over the past hour, you've been listening to articles from the December 6th to December 12th edition of The Economist, the weekly news magazine from Great Britain. I'm Steve Veitch, and it has been my pleasure to read them. Thanks for listening. Tune in next week for another reading of The Economist, and I'll be back with you in 2 weeks. And as always, I remind you that if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand. In fact, you can listen to this and most other Sun Sounds programs at your convenience with On Demand. Just go to sunsounds.org/broadcastinfo and audio/on demand.